animosities. And there was the weird feeling that the Kremlin Death Star was endorsing and promoting all of it. The voices that rose above the din spoke in strident tones of all they knew to be right and good in the world: Western culture and tradition, Christianity, and the superiority of the white race, a race whose honored values faced the threat of extinction. The West has been polluted by the virus of decadence, of liberalism, of homosexuality, of the destruction of the family, inveighed a delegate from a right-wing group in Scotland. Chris Roman, the lead delegate from Belgium, agreed. "Soon in the West, it will be possible to marry a dog or a penguin," he said. "Children under 5 are taught how to play with themselves, and children over 5 are taught that being gay is normal." BuzzFeed's Max Seddon reported that the delegates railed variously against Freemasons, the corrupting influence of Hollywood, Nazi fascists in the EU, a global cabal of blood-sucking oligarchs, non-white immigrants practicing alien traditions, fags and dykes, and Zionist puppet filth. For all the apparent thrill of being able to say what they really felt among friends without fear of sanction, thank you, Cossack-suited guard, thank you, Kremlin-endorsed free speech, there was a sense of disappointment about the final attendance. Europe's bigger and better-financed right-wing nationalist political parties had ditched the conference. Apparently, the leading fascists in Europe didn't care to be associated with the self-declared neo-Nazis, and vice versa. Marine Le Pen, for instance, was happy to take big loans from a Russian bank to help finance the National Front in France. But she didn't want to be seen as too closely allied with this particular element right now, not with a national election on the horizon. The leading far-right nationalist parties in Austria, Hungary, and Serbia all begged off, too. Even the leader of the party that organized the conference, Russia's Rodina Motherland Party, scuttled out of town at the last minute on what he claimed was important but unspecified business. The folks who did show up at this multinational mind meld didn't lack for ardor. The air in their conference room hung heavy with a desperate need to belong to something. "What I'm looking for in Russia," said the Italian fascist Roberto Fiore, "is deep political and philosophical understanding." Alas, the community they managed to conjure felt a little thin that icy day in St. Petersburg. A Ukrainian academic who specializes in the rise of nationalist political movements in Europe described some of the conference's highlighted speakers. "Roberto Fiore has almost 40 years of experience of far-right activism," wrote Anton Shahovsov. "But in the most recent general election in Italy, his party, New Force, obtained only 0.26% of the vote. Greece's Golden Dawn has limited impact on Greek politics. The Belgian, Chris Roman, whom the organizers proudly described as chairman of the Euro-Russia Research Center, is most likely the only member of this research center. Nick Griffin, former leader of the British National Party, who was expelled from his party in the autumn of 2014, represented the British Unity, a virtual party that largely exists on Facebook, with 4,000 likes. The leading delegate from the United States, founding editor of the white supremacist online magazine American Renaissance, surveyed the room from his own spot at the dais and judged it wanting. "It's a bizarre lineup," Jared Taylor told BuzzFeed. "The fringe of the fringe." This revelation did not dampen Jared Taylor's hopes for this arid little seedbed of nationalist brotherhood. At least they had enemies to lash out at, together. "We are all united here in our opposition to globalization and in our love of traditional societies," Taylor told the room. "Tradition is under attack. One way is to replace the people who created traditions with an entirely different people. This is happening in the modern world through immigration. Another way to destroy tradition is to try to undermine the traditions of a people and replace them with alien traditions. So there are two main ways by which tradition is destroyed: by replacing or diluting a people with foreigners, or by persuading a people to accept alien traditions." Taylor apologized for America's misguided embrace of diversity, which he considered a form of national suicide. We are all brothers and sisters, members of the same great family of Western man. But we are a small minority on this planet. Our numbers are shrinking, while those of every other group are growing. That is why we must have territories that are exclusively ours, which are for us alone and for our children forever. Without this, everything we love will be washed away. One of the few rock stars at the event was a young rebel warrior just off the front lines in Donbas, where he claimed he was fighting the evil fascist government in Kiev, which was out to exterminate all ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine. Even for the delegates, it was a dizzying exercise to keep track of just which fascists they were for and which they were against. "I'm a nationalist," said Alexei Milchikov, who promised to return the Donbas to the warm bosom of Mother Russia. "I am a patriot of my people. Right now in Europe, there's an attempt to blur the lines, to mix everyone up." Fellow attendees hurrahed this sentiment and railed against the United States and the EU for unjustly vilifying Vladimir Putin's ongoing attempts to bring back the pieces of Ukraine that rightfully belong to the Russian people. Putin's nemesis in Russia came in for particular scorn at the conference, including Boris Nemtsov, who had been murdered steps from the Kremlin just 3 weeks earlier. "I know where they live," the Belgian Chris Roman said of Boris Nemtsov and a number of other also recently deceased Putin critics. "They live in hell." Even in absentia, Vladimir Putin, proud native of St. Petersburg, was the hero of the day. Conference literature bannered excerpts from one of his recent speeches. "We can see how many of the Euro-Atlantic countries are actually rejecting their roots, including the Christian values that constitute the basis of Western civilization. They are denying moral principles and all traditional identities, national, cultural, religious, and even sexual. They are implementing policies that equate large families with same-sex partnerships, belief in God with the belief in Satan. People in many European countries are embarrassed or afraid to talk about their religious affiliations. Holidays are abolished or even called something different. Their essence is hidden away, as is their moral foundation. And people are aggressively trying to export this model all over the world. I am convinced that this opens a direct path to degradation and primitivism, resulting in a profound demographic and moral crisis." Ah, here was a true moral leader. This was the consensus of the first ever International Russian Conservative Forum. "The salvation of my generation is the great Russian people, because Vladimir Putin understands that the rights of the majority should be put before the whims and perversions of the minority," exclaimed the Scottish delegate beneath a photoshopped picture of a bare-chested Putin riding a bear. "Obama and America, they're like females. They're feminized men. You have been blessed with a man who is a man, and we envy that." Did I mention the picture of Putin was bare-chested? The image of Putin projected onto the whiteness of the low-ceilinged Holiday Inn conference room inspired feelings that might make a new bride blush. Here was the shirtless, modern-day nationalist Leonidas riding his ursine mount. And the International Russian Conservative Forum delegates in that room were Sparta's 300 bravest, there to hold back the hordes until the rest of the West could work up a sufficient appreciation of the dangers that lurked. The Russian journalist Ilya Azar sat in on the keynote speeches and couldn't quite believe their Putin worship. "Lenin died, Thatcher died, Buddha died, Muhammad died, but Jesus lives. God will save Russia. God will save the Russian people. God will save Vladimir Putin." Azar described the culmination of that little riff as quite unexpected. The scene outside the hotel, however, betrayed the feebleness of the forum. The organization's website had basically begged for protesters. "Enemies of Russia will not stop the International Russian Conservative Forum from taking place." But these fringe creeps didn't even warrant a proper counter-demonstration. A dozen or so young men and women, easily outnumbered by police and the Cossack guards, they banged drums in pots. They chanted, "Nazi fuck off, no to fascism." They waved handmade signs, Nazis licking Putin's ass. OMG. We don't want foreign Nazis in St. Petersburg. We have enough of our own. The fascists in attendance complained about being called Nazis. The outright Nazis sporting swastika tattoos said they were a little hurt by that. A few of the loudest protesters were carted off to jail. One of the Cossack guards was wrist-slapped for ripping up a sign. Other than that, the only casualty seemed to be the hotel chain itself. I will always spread information about how this hotel lets in neo-Nazis, one young man told Azar. And of course, I will never set foot in another Holiday Inn. By the time a fake bomb threat broke up the conference, police suspected the call had actually come from one of the attendees trying to drum up a little press. The first annual forum had been deemed by disinterested observers ineffectual and pathetic. The flotsam and jetsam of right-wing fringe groups, Anna Nemtsova called the attendees in the Daily Beast. This confab was for losers, who can feel, in Russia, like they found people who really understand and sympathize with them. The whole scene invited more mockery than scorn, especially when it came to the sidebar participants like Nathan Smith, who called himself the foreign minister of the Texas Nationalist Movement, a group advocating for the secession and reestablishment of an independent Republic of Texas. Nathan Smith made very little impression at the forum itself, his Texas-sized cowboy hat notwithstanding. He was not among the 24 featured speakers. But he did take some time to explain to local reporters the ideals of this secession movement in Texas and how the U.S. government was trying to artificially create the American identity. He was quoted in the Russian online newspaper Vizglat. Texans need independence because we have a completely different vision of the world and of politics, and we are not at all in agreement with the policy of the U.S. federal government. Today in power, there are simply no people who represent the interests of the people of Texas. At the same time, we pay taxes that go up to Washington. Tell me, why do we need to belong to the United States? The Texas secessionists were a 250,000 strong, Smith insisted, and could point to comments by a recent governor of the state as more or less official proof that the movement was as serious as a heart attack. When we came in the Union in 1845, one of the issues was that we would be able to leave if we decided to do that, Rick Perry had asserted, without benefit of any factual underpinning. You know, my hope is that America and Washington in particular pays attention. We've got a great union. There's absolutely no reason to dissolve it. But if Washington continues to thumb their nose at the American people, you know, who knows what may come out of that? Governor Perry had since walked that back a bit, but not exactly all the way. Most Americans might have understood that as Rick Perry being Rick Perry, flirting with Texas bad boy chauvinism in the hopes of distracting people from the fact that he was about to attempt to run for president while simultaneously being under felony criminal indictment. Oops. But today's stupid political machismo stunt might become tomorrow's international flying wedge. And so Putin's government threw in with the wingnut Texans, not to mention separatists you could find in Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Catalonia, to name a few. Russia likened their desire for independence to that of the Russian speakers in Crimea, which Russia had heroically broken away from Ukraine, and in the Donbas, which Russia was trying to break away from Ukraine. In the wake of that garrulous St. Petersburg interview in 2015 with the foreign minister from the Republic of Texas, almost nobody in the West took much notice of the sudden explosion in Free Texas tweets. Politico's Casey Michel was on this story early, reporting the strange happenings in real time. But experts and Russia watchers in the West waved off all this Texit business as absurdist political theatrics from the Kremlin. It's just another mischief-making gambit, nothing seriously to be worried about, NYU professor Mark Galliotti explained to Michelle. Were the Texas separatists not both noisy and willing to play nice with Moscow, I doubt it would get much play. It's just another case of taking advantage of whichever useful idiots happen to present themselves. Maybe in an earlier age, but this was a different time. a moment when Vladimir Putin had growing, urgent, and increasingly hostile geopolitical imperatives, and when his intelligence apparatchiks were beginning to understand the power of certain new political tools at their disposal. Those Free Texas tweets were the first little pinholes that allowed a glimpse of a really weird future to come. To see how and where that future was being charted, to see how the freakish, the virulent, and the ugly were being weaponized for new uses, all you'd have to do is hail a cab under the portico of the St. Petersburg Holiday Inn that March day and get a ride 9 miles north to the squat four-story office building at 55 Savishkina, home of the Internet Research Agency. The dark, heavy drapes were pulled tight on the windows day and night, so 55 Savishkina was a mystery even to people who lived and worked in the neighborhood, a subject of much gossip and speculation. There were suspicions that the Internet Research Agency was a seven-day-a-week, round-the-clock operation, but outsiders didn't know the half of it. There were only a few minutes a day when the hundreds of laptops in the warren of offices were idle. The bosses of the Internet Research Agency ran the operation on two separate 12-hour shifts, which meant if you were in the area just before 9 o'clock in the morning or just before 9 o'clock at night, you could see small contingents of 20-somethings streaming in and out of 55 Savishkina. "They're so cool, like they're from New York," one observer told American reporter Adrian Chen. "Very hip clothing, very hip tattoos." Many of these young professionals had been drawn to the Internet Research Agency by the ads that started appearing back in 2013. "Internet operators required. Task: posting comments on specialized internet sites, writing thematic posts, blogs, social networks, screenshot reports, free power supply. Learning is possible." Setting aside the weirdness that in a country floating on gas and oil, a free power supply at work is an advertisable perk, it's clear that jobs at the Internet Research Agency were coveted. Most of the hundreds of young people who worked at 55 Savishkina made around $700 a month, under the table, in cash. No need to report it to the tax authorities. This was very good money indeed for playing make-believe on your computer 12 hours a day. 2 days on, 2 days off. The salary was equal to that of a full professor at a local university, or close to that of a journalist, armed with legitimate facts and at considerable risk of being killed or imprisoned, noted Sam Zelich in an essay for PEN America. In the Russian workforce, there's as much money in chaos as there is in news. Most all of the fun at the Internet Research Agency was in creating personas that could comment and blog and post and tweet and network with people anywhere in the world. A European fortune teller who opined on dating, dieting, crystals, and feng shui. A young professional woman who unleashed bon mots about Kim Kardashian's latest naked selfie. A specialist in vintage automobile repair living on a sunny coast in Central America. A movie critic in Los Angeles. It was an opportunity for them to live a life they always dreamed about and to pretend to be somebody else, explained Lyudmila Savchuk, who in March 2015 had only recently left the company. "They can be a gorgeous knockout. They can be bodybuilders. They can live in any part of the globe, in America. They could live the life they've always wanted to live, through the internet." Whatever the psychological benefits of the fantasy elements of the work, the physical work environment on Savishkina Street was no Silicon Valley startup with foosball and craft beer and office dogs. Didn't matter if you were a member of the graphics team, the data analysis team, the department of commentators, the department of bloggers, the department of social networking professionals, or the rapid response department. They created such an atmosphere that people would understand they were doing something important and secretive, says Savchuk. "Humorless and draconian" was how a reporter from The Guardian described the outfit in a long investigative piece early in 2015. The Internet Research Agency was engaged in constant, rapid response-driven information warfare. Speaking to coworkers was frowned upon. Talking about the work to anybody outside the building was forbidden. The non-disclosure form was the first thing a new employee signed. Show up late and you were docked pay. Fall short on the quota of work and you were docked pay. The folks on the social media teams were expected to produce 5 political posts, 10 non-political posts, and more than 150 comments every 2 days, without fail. The topics and tenor of the political content were decided at the top every day. We'd come in, turn on a proxy server to hide our real location, and then read the technical tasks we had been sent, an Internet Research Agency employee explained to The Guardian in March 2015. Most of the technical tasks the previous year, as the agency was getting its sea legs, centered on Ukraine, looking for ways to justify Putin's invasion and takeover of Crimea and his ongoing military effort to do the same in the Donbas. Daily tasks called for savaging the new democratically elected pro-EU, pro-US, anti-Russian government in Kyiv. They were fascists, anti-Semites, baby killers. Ukrainians fighting in their own country against out-of-uniform Russian soldiers and artillery and tanks were invariably described as terrorists. The more shocking, the better for the fake stories about heinous atrocities committed by the Ukrainians against the Russian freedom fighters in the Donbas. In the first days of March 2015, immediately following the assassination of the Putin critic Boris Nemtsov, technical task orders spurred hundreds of posts and tweets pointing fingers at Ukraine for the murder. It wasn't Putin, but the government in Kyiv that had killed Boris Nemtsov. How does that even remotely make sense? Oh, follow along, why don't you? See, the Ukrainians killed him as an exercise in reverse psychology. Shooting Boris Nemtsov on the night before his big anti-war march was designed to stir up anti-Putin opposition in Russia. Oh, yeah, killing an anti-Putin leader, that's obviously a plot against Putin. The murder is pure provocation. The state is doing everything to catch Nemtsov's murderers. Putin's best specialists have been sent to fulfill this goal. There was no evidence, no hint of corroboration to back up this nonsensical claim. Which means you just have to make it more loudly and more frequently. The ops at the Internet Research Agency counted on a sentiment that had been invoked by one of the white nationalist speakers at that galactic freak show International Russian Conservative Forum across town. 100 repetitions make one truth. The defenders of the truth can be overwhelmed by repeated lies. No lie was too outlandish, as long as it could at least plausibly confuse the real news. And as long as it increased anti-Ukraine, anti-Western online traffic and noise. The analytics department at 55 Savishkina tracked the metrics, how many comments, how often shared or forwarded or retweeted, and fed all that information to the technical taskmasters for message refinement. And it wasn't just about shaping the response to real events that people would normally be talking about. The Internet Research Agency spread word of stories and ideas and characters that otherwise wouldn't get a second glance if it weren't for the artificial hype its employees were churning out on a 24-hour, no-rest, double-shift schedule. The morning after Foreign Minister Nathan Smith of the Texas National Movement gave his interview across town in St. Petersburg, Internet research trolls were tasked to weigh in on the momentous secession crisis facing the Lone Star State. Dozens of tweets and social media posts started popping up, ready to be shared and retweeted all across America, and in not particularly bad English. Some linked to what appeared to be earnest editorials, such as this little ditty. Perhaps nowhere else in the United States have local people discussed the topic of the annexation of Crimea to Russia as in the state of Texas. The reason for the keen interest of the Texans to this problem is that the history of Crimea has much in common with the history of their own state. Yeah, sure. That's what Texas separatists were all about. Solidarity with Russian-speaking Crimeans in the Ukraine. In the hands of Putin's internet trolls, any secessionist movement anywhere, however lame and parochial, could be adopted and mislabeled and harnessed to help run down the West. And the social media fakery didn't end there either. Internet research soon set up its own Facebook page promoting secession, and it was a hit. Heart of Texas drew followers by the tens of thousands, all of whom could be spoon-fed content devised by Russian agents in St. Petersburg, and in turn pass it on to who knows how many Facebook friends and Twitter followers. Heart of Texas was one of scores of Facebook pages controlled by the Internet Research Agency, not to mention thousands more social media identities and accounts operating on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, all created at 55 Savishkina. By early 2015, when the St. Petersburg Holiday Inn was spinning its international Lazy Susan of Nazis and fringe separatists, the Internet Research Agency's secret drive to expand the malevolent presence of covert Russian trolls in Americans' online lives was already a busy and expanding operation. The United States was the key and crucial target. Putin's Kremlin was committed to the mission of mucking with American democracy in general, and the 2016 election in particular, and committed to a very modern method. The days of depending on hapless illegals and mopey spies at the UN mission in New York were over. The return on investment had been too paltry. But the American virtual world was wide open and fertile with new possibility. It was also a fraction of the cost of active and actual human intelligence operations. Think of the Internet Research Agency's English language department as a team of 400 Guccifers, only with quality control engineers to fix up cultural references, usage and grammar, and data analytics specialists and IT specialists, and an endless array of protected virtual private networks behind them. The heart of Putin's cynical play was information warfare, featuring cyber nuisances like trolling and cyber crimes like identity theft and email hacking and outright stealing. Putin's military intelligence and his foreign service pros were handling the most daring cybercrimes. The savvy, well-paid kids at Internet Research were handling the rest, which meant the English language department at 55 Savishkina had already become the favored elite in the building. They were the highest paid crew at 55 Savishkina and the hardest working. Even those with the best English language skills had to master new areas of expertise. Learning is possible. They had to know how to use stolen identities to set up fake American-sounding accounts on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. They had to study up on information provided by fellow agents recently returned from intelligence and contacts-gathering trips in the actual Nevada, California, New Mexico, Illinois, Michigan, Georgia, New York, and Texas. They had to know where the most damage could be done. A guy in Texas had told Russia's agent on tour it was the purple states, but what exactly were those? They had to discern which politically connected figures and follower-heavy celebrities sprinkled internet traffic magic dust that might just rub off on anybody who engaged them. And they had to be schooled in how to engage those mighty influencers. National Rifle Association's Wayne LaPierre, we're looking at you. E! Entertainment's Kim Kardashian, we're looking at you, too. They had to get up to speed on American culture and politics, and specifically the most contentious and divisive issues of the day: immigration, gun laws, race, the Confederate flag. They had to spend hours screening one slightly cartoonish but very popular political series on Netflix. At first, we were forced to watch The House of Cards in English, said one of the trolls who worked at IRA in 2015. It was necessary to know all the main problems of the United States of America. Tax problems, the problem of gays, sexual minorities, weapons. Our goal wasn't to turn Americans toward Russia. Our goal was to set Americans against their own government, to provoke unrest, provoke dissatisfaction. Chapter 27. All They Have Is This. After 2 years of investigation by the FBI and the Office of Special Counsel, and more investigation by a handful of congressional committees, not to mention the relentless digging by dozens of able and talented professional reporters, we pretty much know how the Russians did it. How they mucked with our electioneering in 2016 in what the special counsel's final report called sweeping and systematic fashion. We know that agents inside Unit 26165 and Unit 74455 of Russia's main intelligence directorate of the General Staff, GRU, used a variety of means to hack the email accounts of the Hillary Clinton for President campaign and its chairman, and to infiltrate and then monitor and infect the computer networks of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the Democratic National Committee. We know from federal indictments they were able to capture keystrokes entered by Democratic Party officials and employees and to take screenshots from their computers. We know Russian military intelligence officers released tens of thousands of stolen emails and documents through online entities they created, like DC Leaks. And, as homage to that lonely but inspiring Romanian hacker, Guccifer 2.0. The GRU-controlled Guccifer 2.0 claimed falsely to be just another lone wolf operative who had stolen all the goods from a laptop on his kitchen table. Fuck the Illuminati and their conspiracies. We know that Russian military intelligence agents used fictitious American-sounding, American-seeming personas, such as Alice Donovan, Jason Scott, and Richard Gingrey, to drive traffic to leaked material. We know the Russians handed over tens of thousands more pilfered emails and documents to WikiLeaks to ensure a wider distribution. We know that WikiLeaks released the first set of emails stolen from Clinton's campaign chairman on a day her opponent really needed a distraction from his own troubles. We also know that the Kremlin-run trolls at the Internet Research Agency were actively spewing incendiary provocations and content designed to promote Donald Trump, leading up to and all the way through the 2016 general election campaign, and then through the start of the Trump administration. Content created by the Internet Research Agency and its brethren is known to have reached well over 100 million Americans in the election season. The IRA greatest hits Facebook pages were Stop AI, meaning All Invaders, complete with many graphics of scary-looking Muslims. Also, Being Patriotic, Blacktivist, and Heart of Texas. Each of those pages got more than 11 million discrete engagements. Heart of Texas, that original chestnut created way back in January 2015, had 200,000 followers by the time the election season was over, more than 5 million likes, and almost 5 million shares. The scary anti-immigrant invaders page got even more. These engagements were dwarfed by the total interactions with the most popular IRA-invented Instagram accounts, all created with the sole purpose of ripping at divisions in the American electorate. One of the Internet Research Agency's fake American personas, Jenna Abrams, 70,000 followers, started out trolling Kim Kardashian and then graduated to trolling people who thought the Confederate flags and monuments in the American South should come down. Did you know that the flag and the war wasn't about slavery? Ms. Abrams scolded. It was all about money. The Internet Research Agency and its data analyzers paid Facebook for ads and boosted posts to stir resentments after police killed young unarmed African Americans in St. Louis, Baltimore, and Cleveland. And after a white supremacist gunman murdered 8 African Americans at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Another level of hate. Unfortunately, American tolerance is not what we think it is, read the ad, for which Facebook pocketed $20 from the St. Petersburg troll farm. What if America is still a deeply racist country? What if the church is not a safe place anymore? When not forcing their dirty fingernails into our various national open wounds, the Savishkina Street trolls pummeled the Democratic nominee with paid advertisements writ ugly. Join our hashtag Hillary Clinton for Prison 2016. Hillary Clinton doesn't deserve the black vote. Ohio wants Hillary for prison. Hillary is Satan, and her crimes and lies had proved just how evil she is. African American voters, the bread and butter of the Democratic base vote, appear to have been targeted more aggressively than any other demographic to turn them against Clinton or to dissuade them from voting altogether. A particular hype and hatred for Trump is misleading the people and forcing blacks to vote Killary, said the Internet Research Agency invented woke blacks. We cannot resort to the lesser of two devils. Then we'd surely be better off without voting at all. The IRA-created United Muslims of America posted an ad that read, American Muslim voters refuse to vote for Hillary Clinton because she wants to continue war on Muslims in the Middle East and voted yes for invading Iraq. An official-sounding but fake 10 GOP account, often assumed to be registered to the Republican state party in Tennessee, shouted out a make-believe story about the election board in Broward County, Florida, illegally counting tens of thousands of fraudulent mail-in ballots marked for Hillary. Hashtag voter fraud. Heart of Texas was also actively corrosive. Its ads decried the Islamization of Texans' once great republic and urged God-fearing Christians in Texas to protest the Islamic Dawah Center in Houston, which had opened its doors more than a decade earlier as a center for worship, education, and outreach to the wider community. The Heart of Texas Post in the spring of 2016 called that Islamic center a shrine of hatred and suggested that protesters feel free to bring along your firearms, concealed or not. American anti-Muslim protesters, in fact, turned out, holding white power symbols and Confederate flags, denouncing the Dawah Center at the time and place directed by Heart of Texas. Houston police had a volatile situation on their hands when a separate and opposing group of protesters, there to support Muslims in general and the Dawah Center in particular, well, they showed up on the same day, at the same time, right across the street. Turns out they had been unwittingly summoned from St. Petersburg, too, by a separate Russian-controlled fake American entity called United Muslims of America. As the election neared, the internet research agency PROS turned both rhetorical barrels on Hillary Clinton. 2 weeks before the election, a Heart of Texas Facebook ad screamed that if the Democratic nominee won the presidency, there would be no choice but to secede, because another Clinton in the White House would mean higher taxes to feed undocumented aliens, more refugees, mosques and terrorist attacks, banned guns, continuing economic depression. We know the outcome of all this, too. We're still living it. Americans can and do argue whether, absent the big Russian push against the Democratic presidential nominee and for the Republican, Trump would have won his narrow electoral college victory in 2016. And Americans can and do argue whether the Trump campaign's many open acts of boosting the efforts of Putin and his military intelligence cybercriminals and his army of Guccifer descendant trolls at 55 Savishkina Street were provably criminal or merely contemptible. But what is undeniably true is that Putin succeeded, probably beyond his wildest imaginings, in his highest real aim. The goal seems to be not domination, but chaos, longtime Moscow correspondent Susan B. Glasser succinctly explained in an essay in Politico a year after the 2016 election. The objective is not to destroy us, but to weaken and confuse us. Putin and his techno-warriors figured out what differences and disagreements and prejudices were corroding the health and cohesion of American society. They found the most ragged faults and fissures in our democracy: immigration, race, religion, economic injustice, mass shootings. And then they poured infectious waste into them. They used traditional media, social media, and disinformation to try to make citizens of differing experiences and viewpoints hate and distrust each other as much as possible. They made public discourse and discussion as evil and mean-spirited and alienating as possible. They created miserable expectations for coarseness and cruelty and blatant dishonesty in politics and civic life. The Russian operation pushed American politicians and political parties to more and more extreme positions. It celebrated all manner of fringe, splinter, and radical politics. It demonized centrists, moderates, and anybody on any point of the ideological spectrum who actually believed the levers of government could be harnessed for anything useful at all. And his achievement came cheap. 1,000, 10,000 highly trained illegals chatting up middle managers at conferences and dead-dropping their expense forms could never have pulled off something this high impact. This new type of operation was infinitely more effective and bargain basement affordable. And because it worked, the blowback has been minimal. At basically zero cost, Putin succeeded in his biggest aim. He corrupted and polluted our most treasured possession, our democracy. Pobeda. Even with an understanding of how he did it and how well it worked, What has not really been answered in any satisfying way is the question of why Putin went out of his way to muck around in our democracy. There are plenty of plausible explanations floating around out there. The most widespread is that Putin really did revile Hillary Clinton and blamed her for roiling political dissent against him inside Russia while she was Secretary of State. She had been so eager and so aggressive in criticizing Russia's kabuki theater democracy. So when Hillary Clinton seemed very likely to win the U.S. presidency in 2016, Putin figured he could at least rough her up pretty good, turn as many Americans against her as possible, and make it that much more difficult for her to govern effectively. Maybe even cast doubt on the legitimacy of her election, the way she had cast such withering doubt on the legitimacy of the Russian elections in 2011 and 2012, when she kept piping up about all the irregularities and stuffed ballot boxes that Putin really didn't want to have to explain, especially not to her. All that was true enough, but not exactly a full and compelling explanation. Go back further than that, back to the root of the thing, back to when Vladimir Putin first became president of the Russian Federation, when it still had the makings of a potential superpower revival. Whatever its hard knocks on the way out of communism, this was the largest country on the face of the earth, with the only nuclear arsenal to match the United States of America. This was the country that gave us Tolstoy and Bolshoi and Pavlov. This was the country that launched the first man-made satellite into space, launched the first man into space. And Russia, at the beginning of our century, also had the most impressive reserves of the most prized and remunerative commodities on Earth, oil and natural gas. It was the sort of inheritance that, husbanded wisely and well, could have funded a border-to-border revival. Education, infrastructure, health services, even fair elections— could have financed new industry and technological advances, could have provided a rich and loamy bed in which a modern republic capable of serving the general welfare of the Russian people would grow. Russia had the wherewithal to remake itself again into one of the most influential and powerful nations on the planet. A free first world Russia would have been a fearsome and worthy competitor in commercial and international affairs. President Putin chose a different path, not least because establishing a diversified economy in post-Soviet Russia would have been really hard, requiring Russia to build and sustain a lot of things it hadn't ever had on a national scale: a reasonable expectation of the impartial rule of law, a reasonably competent government responsive to its people, reasonable public investment in the kind of physical and financial infrastructure that allows businesses to get established and grow, reasonable prospects for upward mobility, and maybe even getting rich if you had talent and gumption and a little good luck. Results may vary as to what counts as reasonable in any one time and place, but a few things were certain. Building that kind of a Russia would take a ton of work, and it would provide no guarantee of a lifetime leadership job for any one ruler, no matter how good he looked shirtless on a bear. Putin opted for a shorter and easier path, which solved two problems. It gave him permanent job security, and it saved Russia the pain in the butt of actually building itself a modern 21st century economy and government. Putin's most fateful decision for his country was that oil and gas wouldn't just be the profitable crown jewel in Russia's diversified economic array. It would be Russia's everything. And Putin would exercise almost complete control over it and use it in whatever way he saw fit. It turns out to have been a colossal mistake with grotesque consequences for Russia, for the United States, for pretty much everyone except the oil and gas industry, and maybe Putin himself. Now in his 20th year running the show, Vladimir Putin presides over a metaphysical unforced error, the tragic scuppering of one of the potentially great nations in the world. Russia has been assiduously engineered into a sclerotic dictatorship, its economy wholly dependent on its one indispensable industry, which is, by design, almost solely monopolized by its big, lousy, non-competitive, state-controlled oil and gas companies, which are all run by spies or thugs or judo guys, and almost exclusively for the benefit of Vladimir Putin and his global aims. Their companies are not exactly soaring on the strength of their R&D prowess. And there's good reason for that. No one in any major Russian enterprise has been allowed to succeed or prosper legitimately and on his own terms. Anyone who rose to any station must owe that assent to Putin and answer to him for it. That has been doubly true in the energy sector, which has been Putin's crucial lever of power. No one in that industry held on to money or power or property except with his say-so and on his ugly terms. If you were trying to become a clean businessman running a capable and profitable energy company outside the control of the Kremlin, you were going to lose that business. Goodbye, Yukos. And maybe do a prison term. Hello, Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Alternatively, if you were a businessman or a crony who played along and served a useful purpose, you'd be rewarded with stolen goods. And you'd better stay loyal, or you could do a prison term too. I mean, look, you've got stolen goods. That's how Russia's premier natural gas company, Gazprom, earned its reputation as the worst managed company on the planet. And that's how the most Putin-loyal yes-man in Russia, Igor Sechin, became one of the most powerful figures in Russia. And how his company, Rosneft, became the behemoth of the country's oil industry, the death destroyer of worlds, eating Yukos and Bashneft and any other cash-making morsels. It's not incidental that as an oil company, Rosneft sucks. It wasn't as if it got big and powerful by streamlining its supply chains and inventing stuff. Rosneft sucks all the time, but especially lately, when, because of sanctions against Russia for its terrible international behavior, it no longer has access to all that nifty Western Arctic and shale drilling technology it needs to reap that increasingly hard-to-get Russian oil. The country, meanwhile, has eroded into a stultifying economic sinkhole for average Russians. Despite receiving $1.6 trillion from oil and gas exports from 2000 to 2011, Russia was not able to build a single multi-lane highway during this time. There is still no interstate highway linking Moscow to the Far East, wrote Karen DeWisha in her richly detailed 2014 book, Putin's Kleptocracy. The inability of well-trained young graduates to succeed as entrepreneurs and innovators in Russia has stimulated emigration and plans to emigrate. DeWisha went on to quote a pollster in Moscow on the plight of young Russians. They have nowhere to go, nothing to do, and nothing to hope for. The lack of adequate medical care produces 5 times more deaths from cardiovascular disease among women in Russia than in Europe, the professor wrote. More Russian women die annually from domestic violence than the number of soldiers the USSR lost in the entire Afghan war. For Russian men, the situation is even grimmer. Poor workplace and road safety standards, plus high rates of suicide and homicide, combined with the negative health effects of high alcohol consumption, to make life especially precarious. According to the World Health Organization, the life expectancy of a 15-year-old male is 3 years lower in Russia than in Haiti. Let that sink in for a second. If you're a 15-year-old boy, your life expectancy is 3 years longer if you are in Haiti than in Russia. Russia under Putin has become warped and stunted, a gigantic multi-continental country of 150 million souls living on an economy considerably smaller than Italy's, with male life expectancy so low that you might think the national pastime really was Russian roulette. This is a manifestation of a recognizable and widespread phenomenon, the resource curse, which has happened over and over again with varying degrees of despair, from the Gulf of Guinea to the southern Great Plains. But Russia added a whole new twist to the curse, a twist that helps explain the international order of things right now, or the lack thereof. When the resource curse takes hold in a country as big and influential and aggressive as 21st century Russia, it turns out to be the entire world's problem. What has happened to Russia is like when a faraway humanitarian concern morphs from a charity cause into an international terrorism threat. Russia's resource curse has become a malignant tumor spreading through the rest of the world. Unlike Soviet-era Russia, which used its oil and gas to provide for its own energy needs and the needs of its worldwide communist satellites, modern petrostate Russia has to sell its fuel on the global market without the benefit of a separate Soviet checkout lane. And that went pretty okay for a while. As recently as the George W. Bush administration, there were those in the United States who thought that Putin might be the great hope for a new Middle East-free global energy supply line. But as Putin's Russian Federation revealed itself to be a robustly corrupt authoritarian regime, happily committed to securing its own survival by force, it repeatedly and increasingly put itself into rogue state territory. And that ultimately screwed up its ability to play in the global markets as if it were some kind of normal country. Putin's best-known exports list has lately comprised the most dreaded organized crime syndicates on earth, money laundering on such a massive industrial scale that it can bring down whole national cornerstone banks in any part of the globe, exotic assassinations, rogue state-friendly weapon systems, illegal out-of-uniform military incursions, and the first seizure of another country's territory in Europe since World War II. That sort of activity can get in the way of a country's global business operations, on the odd chance that there's anyone on the face of the globe who sees it as their responsibility to punish and isolate the kinds of international bad actors that invade their neighbors, shoot down civilian airliners, and send intelligence officers armed with nerve agent to assassinate their exiles in British cathedral towns. Russia's way out of this existential conundrum has had two components: one business, one pleasure. The business part is tidy. With the broken-nosed, no-necked ex-spies perched atop the management structure of Rosneft and Gazprom, Russia's not exactly running a world-class operation when it comes to the production of its one indispensable commodity. Russia's economic future therefore depends on Putin making deals with major international oil and gas companies who can be counted on to understand his imperatives and to not care at all about ethics and governance and geopolitical consequences of their cozying up to the Kremlin. Those kinds of deals aren't just beneficial to the Russian economy, they are critical necessities for Putin's one-track plan for 21st century Russia. And it turns out that as long as Putin is honoring the sanctity of contract and implementing friendly tax laws, industry leaders from the West have shown little hesitation in making those deals. So that's the business part. The pleasure part is less tidy, but presumably way more fun for its practitioners. If the problem is that Russia's behavior is too outré to be accepted in the global economy, then change the expectations for what counts as outré. Be the leveler. Corrupt other countries. Gain control over the former Soviet states in the near abroad by owning their politicians, by controlling the range of possibilities their people are allowed to choose for themselves. Ruin exemplars of governance and responsive democracy. Support separatism and the dissolution of bonds and treaties and Western norms wherever they're vulnerable. Become internationally powerful through force when you can muster it, or sabotage. Cheating is now Russia's most viable avenue in world affairs. And you can mark the precise time when all other avenues were sealed off: the immediate aftermath of Putin's shocking seizure of Crimea and his drive to forcibly annex much of the resource-rich eastern Ukraine. Back in 2014, there was still enough U.S.-led traditional Western governance in the world to punish him with seriously harsh economic sanctions. Even those European countries Putin believed were so dependent on his natural gas supplies agreed that he'd gone too far, and it was time to say no in a meaningful way. Those economic sanctions look like a pretty simple crime and punishment story from our vantage point, but from the Russian perspective, the sanctions were much more gravely threatening. All of a sudden, Putin and his siloviki had been stripped of Western oil and gas technology they desperately needed. all of a sudden, they were unable to simply buy the fast-developing industry expertise required to stay competitive in the all-shook-up, well-fracked new world order. Russia was literally barred by law from tapping that expertise. Even Putin's friends at ExxonMobil, who had aided Rosneft in making that tantalizing discovery of potentially billions of barrels of oil and oil equivalents off Russia's Arctic shelf in the Kara Sea, they couldn't help. This is the vexing predicament facing the Kremlin. Putin's thug dream of resurgent Russian dominance, fueled by oil and gas, is one that can't come true without international help to make his one indispensable industry capable of competing in the global market. And he can't get that international help as long as he's recognized as a gangster and treated like one. Putin and his lieutenants had been defiant when the sanctions first began to bite and ExxonMobil had been forced to pull up stakes in the Arctic. Russians could create their own Arctic-busting technology, they claimed, and promised to fund state-owned oil services companies to match any in the West. "We will do it on our own," Igor Sechin told reporters back in 2014. "We'll continue drilling here in the Kara Sea next year and the years after that." 6 months later, sanctions still in place, Sechin was forced to admit Rosneft lacked the equipment and technology to drill in the Arctic in the 2015 season. 6 months after that, the Russian Energy Ministry said Rosneft would be lucky to return to a drilling platform in the Kara Sea before 2021. ExxonMobil, through it all, kept signaling to Putin and Sechin that it stood ready and willing to do the drilling for them, just as soon as those sanctions were lifted. But until then, the Putin-run oil and gas industry, the single engine powering the Russian economy, would be left to sputter. The country would stagnate and ultimately economically recede as the rest of the world drilled and fracked gas and oil that Russia could only make big, dumb moon eyes at. So as of 2015, Putin faced a rapidly diminishing ability to use oil and gas as a substitute for legitimate global power, and no way forward without some kind of move, any move, no matter how nutty, to get those sanctions lifted and to relieve Russia of the burden of U.S.-led opprobrium and global Western leadership. It was worth trying almost anything. As Special Counsel Mueller and reporters throughout Europe and America have made clear, the Russian Federation ultimately embarked on a deliberate and aggressive campaign to tear apart Western alliances, to rot democracy, and to piss in the punch bowl of free elections all over the civilized world. It continues to this day. And Putin isn't doing this because of Russia's strength, not according to people who have watched the action up close. Russia gives the impression that I am a lion who walks through the world hitting France with one paw, with the other Britain and America, says Romanian security expert Dan Dungaciu. But it's not a lion. It is rather in the role of a hyena, which senses a crisis and goes there and plays on the crisis. The leaders of actually strong countries who have pushed back against Putin understand, too. "I understand why he has to do this, to prove he's a man," Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has said. "He's afraid of his own weakness. Russia has nothing, no successful politics or economy. All they have is this." Putin has no one to blame but himself. He chose a future for Russia in which neither the economy nor the polity would be free. And that choice made Russia a weakling, a second-rate, second-world piker. Russia competes by shoveling toxic matter into the rest of the world's proverbial food supply, hoping to make everyone else as sick as possible, or at least as sick as it is. When the people of Ukraine stand up and make a rational decision for themselves, and toss out the fantastically corrupt Viktor Yanukovych and Putin's other henchman in Kiev, the natural gas middleman Dmitry Firtash, all Putin knows to do is turn to a different type of corruption. He attacks with lies and disinformation because those are the only cards he has to play to prevent the Ukrainian people from making rational decisions in their own national interest. "So Russian-speaking Ukrainians are being lynched," Putin's lying internet trolls scream. "And so they're only rising up to defend themselves. Ukraine's Orange Revolutionaries are neo-Nazis. Yulia Tymoshenko is the real natural gas swindler. Don't you agree, U.S. public relations firms, U.S. political consultants, U.S. banks, U.S. white shoe law firms? If the price is right, would you agree? If that kind of corrupting is your best card, if that's your only real shot at international influence, or at least meting out some sort of punishment for the debilitating sanctions regime that followed the grab in Ukraine, then get hacking. It's cheap, it's doable, and it doesn't require making anybody think better of Russia. The agents of the Kremlin just have to tell the lies often enough and loud enough to sow doubt and dissension, to prove that leaders and governments and institutions in the United States are just as crappy as Russia's. And if Putin learned anything observing the winning-is-all oil and gas executives at ExxonMobil and BP and Chevron, or enablers at Morgan Stanley or Davis Manafort Partners International or Skadden, he learned that there are plenty of folks in the West who are happy to be part of it, happy to pitch in. Useful idiots can be found. They're not even particularly hard to find, judging from a couple little emails that Vladimir Putin or any other sentient person on the planet could Google and read at his leisure today. Russian pop singer Emin Agalarov just called and asked me to contact you with something very interesting, an entertainment publicist had written to Donald Trump Jr. on June 3, 2016, when Putin's disinformation campaign in the U.S. was well underway. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia met with his father, Aras, this morning, and in their meeting offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. If it's what you say, Trump Jr. replied a mere 17 minutes later, I love it. Chapter 28. Constituency Trumps Everything. On the incongruously sun-splashed late winter morning of March 2, 2016, on a remote strip of roadway north of Oklahoma City, the charred body of Aubrey McClendon was pulled lifeless from the driver's seat of his 2013 Chevy Tahoe. There were no skid marks to suggest McClendon had bothered to hit the brakes as he piloted his SUV across the trafficless oncoming lane and into a concrete bridge abutment at 78 miles per hour. He pretty much drove straight into the wall, Captain Paco Balderrama of the Oklahoma City Police Department explained. There was plenty of opportunity to correct or go back to the roadway. That didn't occur. The medical examiner determined that Aubrey was likely killed on impact as a result of multiple blunt force trauma. The death, as per the ME report, was ruled an accident. The extenuating circumstances, though, were strongly suggestive of suicide by automobile. The afternoon before McClendon's fatal crash, a grand jury in Oklahoma City's federal courthouse had weighed in on the quality of the evidence turned up in a long and intense investigation into Aubrey's business practices. Beginning at least as early as December 2007 and continuing until at least as late as March 2012, read the fresh criminal indictment, the defendant, Aubrey K. McClendon, and his co-conspirators knowingly entered into and engaged in a combination and conspiracy to suppress and eliminate competition by rigging bids for certain leasehold interests and producing properties. The feds were trying to hang on Aubrey what they hung on John D. Rockefeller, a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Aubrey began his defense that evening and defiantly, I am proud of my track record in this industry, and I will fight to prove my innocence and clear my name. He was bolstered by some of the best legal counsel money can buy. The prosecutors have wrongfully singled out Aubrey McClendon and have wrongly charged an innocent man, said his attorneys Abby Lowell, who would go on to front for Trump administration Crown Prince Jared Kushner in his various legal snarls, and Emmett Flood, who would sign on to protect President Trump himself from the legal jeopardy arising from the special counsel's probe. Starting today, Aubrey gets his day in court, where we will show that this prosecutorial overreach was completely unjustified. The next morning, shortly after receiving word that the biggest investor in his new oil and gas venture was not going to be putting another dime into the enterprise, Aubrey McClendon got into his SUV and drove alone into eternity. Thousands paid their respects in the days that followed. The encomiums were widespread and heartfelt. The quality of life we have come to enjoy in Oklahoma City is due in no small part to his vision and generosity, said the chairman of the city's Chamber of Commerce. Aubrey was chiefly remembered, in public anyway, as the spur and the engine that had pushed OKC to finally, after decades of effort, realize its major league aspirations. There were the boathouses on the Oklahoma River to point to, the dorms and athletic facilities at OU, the world-beating cancer treatment center, the beautiful Chesapeake Energy Campus, the Whole Foods, and of course, the large and happy NBA crowds at Chesapeake Energy Arena. Kevin Durant and his teammates were thundering up to the playoffs once again. And all of it was true. But the dark side of Aubrey McClendon's career was not easily elided. The apologists referred to Aubrey as embattled. Others, less charitable, called him disgraced. There was that federal criminal indictment, for starters, and a raft of civil suits left to his estate to defend. His new oil and gas venture shuttered in a matter of weeks after his death, more than 100 people out of work. The company he had founded and run for 2 decades was still staggering 3 years after his forced departure, unable to dig itself out from McClendon-led financial shenanigans. Chesapeake Energy had shed 2/3 of its employees in the previous 5 years, and its stock had recently sunk to $1.59 a share, capping a spectacular swoon from $70 a share at the height of the natural gas bubble. Bloomberg Businessweek's ominously titled Postmortem on McClendon, The Shale Reckoning Comes to Oklahoma, noted that Standard & Poor's had downgraded Chesapeake's credit rating for the 4th time since October, calling its $9.8 billion debt load unsustainable. Word on the street was that Chesapeake was headed toward bankruptcy. Analysts were beginning to ask this head